I'm going to discuss Proverbs chapter 15. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 8. And it says, "The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to God, and the prayer of the righteous is his will." Okay? Okay, that's a statement. Clear? Okay. Now, there are two questions that we have to ask. The first question is we cannot know anything about God. And when you say that God is abominated, it means he's disgusted, right? That means you're saying something about God. You say God has disgust and God is happy with the prayers of the righteous, which we cannot say. So that's the first problem. And the second thing, even if you are going to say it, what does this have to do with Proverbs? The purpose of Proverbs is to teach a human being how to deal in the physical world, in the laws of nature, how to evaluate and make decisions. Sadia Gaon in his introduction says that a person, when there's something painful, so you should evaluate the pain that he will have now versus the results that he'll have later. And the same thing when you're going to have pleasure, you must, if there's any effects to this pleasure or any consequences, then you must evaluate the present situation versus the future situation. Okay? So the thing is, all of Proverbs is to teach us in great detail how to make these evaluations and how to analyze these evaluations. Okay? Now, that God is going to be disgusted or it's an abomination to God, I mean, what does that have to do with the subject of Proverbs? It simply doesn't belong here. What does the wicked do? What is the wicked sacrifice? Okay, that's a good question. Ezra says that the sacrifice of the wicked means that it was stolen. And the Ralbach says that he has bad thoughts. Okay? But both of them have one thing in mind when they say Zevach Hashem, the sacrifice of the wicked. That a person is doing a religious act and he is hiding the fact that he is wicked. See, both of them are saying that is the subject. When a person is doing a religious act and hiding the fact that he's really religious, he's hiding behind religiosity to cover up his wickedness. Question is he hiding the fact that he's wicked, or is a wicked act? According to the Ibn Ezra, it's a stolen animal, but he's doing a religious act through the means of a wicked act. He's doing a righteous thing. According to the Rambam, he's like faking out the public. He's trying to fool the public into believing he's a religious person. And in reality, he is not. Third sacrifice, when he says sacrifice, it represents a religious act. Represents a religious act. You notice on the other side, it says the prayers of the righteous. The prayers of the righteous means that he's doing things in private. You can't see a person's prayers. But the thing is, see, the wicked person does religious acts in public to cover up his wickedness. But however, the righteous do their relating to God in a private, you don't see the motives and the thoughts of the righteous. And therefore, he does his because he has nothing to do with the public. He just relates to God directly. It seems like everybody has certain wicked thoughts at sometime or other. And does that mean they're wicked? No, the thing is like this. I one time heard a saying, it's something like this, that the dreams, the acts of the wicked are the dreams of the righteous. Okay? In other words, we all have wicked thoughts. But the only thing is, a righteous person has no plans of carrying it out. You see, he realizes it's an emotion, and he realizes it's a weakness, and he realizes he has to deal with it, and he has to make sure it doesn't come to be any act. He realizes he has to watch it. But however, the wicked, that's what we're talking about, the wicked, that he makes plans in practicality to carry out his wickedness, like according to the Ibn Ezra, the wicked person actually stole the animal to bring for a sacrifice. You understand? The very act of religiosity is through a sin. That we're not talking about. In other words, if you have evil thoughts, that is nothing wrong. That's human, except maybe on a very, very high level. And even there, I mean, we don't have saints in our religion. We have human beings that are human. So therefore, insofar as you have an evil thought, there's nothing wrong. You can't be condemned for that. The wicked person, his evil thoughts, he's carrying out in actions, but he wants to cover it up from the public through his religiosity. Is by abomination. See, we can only know how God relates to us. And God relates to us in three ways. One is through the laws of nature. Two is through his personal intervention in particular cases. And three is miracles. Okay, those are the three methods in which God relates to us. Now, Proverbs deals basically with the first way God relates to us, through the laws of nature. Okay? So therefore, therefore, when it says it's abomination of God, we're talking about how God relates to us. We're talking about the laws of nature. And therefore, the laws of nature are such that that this type of person will be destroyed. This person within the laws of nature will have to be destroyed. That's what it means. When we're dealing with the laws of nature, and the laws of nature where we're going to predict that the laws of nature will destroy you, we are talking about high probability. When it's the second level, God's intervention, there's no question. God will cause it to happen, you see. But where we deal with, where God create, when he created the laws of nature, he created the laws of nature to fit in to the philosophy of Torah. You see, there's a medrash which says that when God wanted to create the world, he looked in the Torah. What does it mean? It means that the laws of nature are created according to the philosophy of Torah. Okay? Now, the thing is that with the laws of nature, it doesn't have to be 100%. It's a high probability that it's going to happen. If you look around you, we'll soon show in detail how it works. But the thing is that if you look around, you will see in high probability that these people will be destroyed. Okay? Writing and explaining an abomination to the Lord only in this case. Why? Because in Proverbs, the subject matter is how to live within the laws of nature and how to evaluate your decisions in the laws of nature. An abomination to God in other areas, I do not know. It's possible that it has the same interpretation, that the laws of nature will destroy you. Or it might have a different meaning in a different subject. See, in our subject, where we're dealing with an evaluation of how to make decisions in everyday life. So an abomination to God means that by nature, you will have to destroy yourself. Works. The way it works is like this. So let's say, for instance, a person cheats. Okay? Let's say in school, he cheats. Now, the worst thing that can happen is if he's successful. Because success is a tremendous motivator to continue on in that path. If you fail, so then you might say, hey, this is not the way to go. Okay? So therefore, success is a tremendous motivator in the emotions where to go. Now, the thing is, if I cheat and I'm successful, and especially if I cheat two or three times and I'm successful, so then my emotions become attached to cheating. Okay? Now, when we cheat, there are a few emotions, not only one, that we are satisfying. The first thing is we're getting results without the work. So therefore, it satisfies my desire not to work. Two, I feel good that I beat the system. Right? Everybody's been competitive, and here I beat the system. Everybody else is doing it normally, and I beat them. I beat my competitors. My classmates are behind, and I'm ahead. You see? Thirdly, I will try for success, even though it will harm others. For instance, I might get into a college which I don't deserve to because of my cheating, and I don't care that others don't. I don't think of others. I think more of myself than another person. You see? Now, any one of these emotions, as you become more entrenched in cheating, so these emotions become, you become more attached to all these emotions of cheating. And therefore, these emotions become more real than reality, and it becomes hard to discern until it reaches a point where you see senators, I mean, there's hardly anybody in the Congress that didn't cheat on the checks, you know, that we just had, and the sexual immorality, they don't feel they're going to get caught. You know what I mean? They go so far because they can't see reality and they feel so secure that they go so far that it has to become public. They have to get caught. You understand? They're going to carry it to such an extent. In other words, a small cheat in high school, maybe you could get away with. But the fact is, as you're successful, you feel more secure. And then there's an ego factor that, look, I could be successful and I won't get caught. So you keep moving further and further out. And as you move further and further out, the odds of you getting caught become greater and greater until it's practically impossible not to get caught. This way, it'll be a miracle if you don't get caught after a while. And a saying here for the person that does evil in a hidden way, that he feels that since it's hidden from the public, he cannot get caught and he will be successful, King Solomon is saying, no way. Because the thing is, your emotions will dig you in so deep, and through your emotions you'll deny reality so much and it'll be so spread out through any one of these four or five emotions that we mentioned before, that somehow, somewhere along the line, you're going to slip and it will become public. That the purpose of Mishlei is to make an evaluation, okay? And I'll show you how it works right here in this verse. In other words, when you're starting out in life and you start doing something that is evil, like by cheating, which you feel that you can't keep hidden. So Mishlei is saying, stop and evaluate that you don't realize that you will be a different person in 10 years. And in 10 years, you will not be watching yourself as closely as you are now and as careful as you are now. Because right now, you have a fear of getting caught. But in 10 years or 15 years, when this becomes second nature to live like that, it's going to come out. So you should stop to think now about your act now, which maybe you could get away with it. But the consequences is 10, 15 years down the pike where you will get caught. Well, you will get caught. See, and what I mean that it's not 100%, it is possible that a human being can go through life and keep his evil hidden and die without getting caught. But what's the probability? You see? The probability is practically nil. You see? That is the approach of Mishlei. How the philosophy of Torah fits right in to the laws of nature. Add one more point, and that is, if you look at the physical world and the laws of nature the way we are looking at it now, and as you go through verse after verse and see how it works, you also have a feeling about the wisdom of God. It's not a magical thing that somehow God is going to get you, but you could see that he created a whole system, the whole science of the physical world, to fit into a philosophy of good and evil, basically. Then you start seeing the real wisdom of God. You see every aspect of how you connect up the philosophy of Torah, the philosophy of Proverbs, and you see it working in the everyday life, and you see how the very laws of nature coincide with that. Then you really see the wisdom of God. You really see it working. It's not like a magical thing, like somehow the hand of God is going to come down. But but you actually see God operating within our everyday life. You really see it clear. See, so then you really start having the wisdom. Even from Proverbs, which just deals with everyday life, you start seeing the wisdom of God here. A person could really be successful if he knows reality and then lives according to that reality. That is living in God's world. You see, to know reality. I'll give you an illustration. The question is, there's a lot of people that have a desire to control the physical world, from disease, from famine, from wars, okay? So for the first few thousand years, they try and experiment in this world called religion. And what they did, they sacrificed animals, they sacrificed people, all the different religions, you know, and they tried to control the world through religion, through sacrifices. Didn't work, you see? But then came scientists that also wanted to control the world. They also had a desire to control the world, but they wanted to control it through the laws of nature. See, they were more successful. Even though that is not the reason why we study. What we study is because we just have we enjoy the truth and reality. We relate to truth and reality, and through truth and reality, we get closer to God as we see God's wisdom in the world. So that brings us closer to God. You see, so we want to just view God's wisdom, you see. So now the same, but I'm saying that the only way a person can be successful is through seeing reality. See, and that's the idea of Mishlei, that you must live a life where you rationally analyze every aspect of the physical world and then live according to it. And you don't have to analyze it yourself. The Torah itself will tell you how to deal with it. That's the book of Mishlei. And this applies to all evil ways. It probably does. But the only thing is, what this verse is talking about is only where you desire to cover up. Where you desire to make, you think you could cover up from the very thing that you're trying to do, to cover up from the physical world your evil. You're a person that you're evil, like, let's say, a congressman that wants to cheat and do all these evil acts, right? Now, the thing is that he feels that it's okay as long as he doesn't get caught. That's his main thing, is he doesn't get caught because he's dependent on the public for votes. What Proverbs is saying here is that don't rely on not getting caught. Don't rely on that. If that's your evaluation, how you're figuring out to make it in life, it's a big mistake. You can't do it. That's all the verse is saying. It might affect other areas, but that's all the verse is saying. Probability get caught, yes. That's what it's saying. Because when you read the newspaper now, you look at a lot of these things that all of a sudden come out. People that wanted to keep their privacy, they just want to live the evil life by themselves. You know what I mean? Everything covered up. All of a sudden, you'll see it come out. You look at that those stories in a totally different light now. You look at it through the eyes of Torah. In the Samuel book 2, at chapter 15, verse 25, is when King David is leaving the city and fleeing from Avshalom, his son. Speaking to Tzadok, the Kohen, the verse 25 says, "And the king said unto Tzadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back again and show me both it and his dwelling." And verse 26 says, "But if he should thus say, I have no delight in thee, here am I, let him do me as seemeth good in his eyes." And it says, saying basically that if God wants me, fine. If he doesn't want me, I'll accept that too. That's basically what he's saying. And I'd like to analyze this this verse from two different angles. The first angle is that in the Medrash, I have a story that that Avraham was when he was by King Nimrod. So they built a big fire, and they said, "Either retract, or we'll throw you into the fire. Either retract about your acceptance of God, and that you don't accept our idols, or we'll throw you into the fire." And there, Avram's brother was standing on the side, And basically, he was saying, well, I'm going to watch, see what happens. So they threw Avraham into the fire, and Avraham lived. So when they asked Avraham's brother what's his decision, he says, hey, I accept God. We threw him in, and he died. Okay? And the Ramban asks, why? Why? The answer is that Avraham accepts God without condition. He accepts God as a reality. Period. Now, if God wants me to live, I'll live. If God wants me to die, I'll die. I accept God's will, period, whether I understand it or not. But however, Avram's brother was saying to God, I will accept you on a very practical basis if I get out of it what I can. Most religionists usually make a trade with God. I will give you prayer, sacrifices, what you want, then you give me what I want. I want certain successes. I want certain protection. Make sure you give it to me. Okay? That is the first thing, is that a relationship to God is simply an acceptance of reality, that God exists. Whether we understand what he's doing, when sometimes it's beneficial, sometimes it looks like it's harmful, we have to accept the will of God at all times. That is the true religious person. That is David HaMelech. That's King David at this point. Okay? Question is, throughout, King David always talked about, especially in the Psalms, that he's always reliant on God for his security. And yet here he is saying that if God doesn't want me, you see, then so be it the will of God. On what is King David, where is King David's security? King David's security is in God, you see. Then at this point, if there's a possibility that God will not accept him anymore, and God does not want him to be king, and God is removing his personal providence over King David, you see, so then he should lose his security. Wherein lies King David's security? Tell you how King David looks at it. I would have to have, you know, facts and information. But let's look at it from our point of view. Okay? Look at God and relate to God altogether. Okay? Now, most people, when they feel a security in God, they feel that God will come down and somehow protect them. Okay? God, like some being, like a parent or a person, will come down and he will protect you. See, that's a physical thing. That we cannot know who God is or what God does, you see. But however, the only way we could know is how God relates to us. So we have to go back there to how God relates to us. That we know. Okay? And since I'm familiar with the laws of nature, so let's see how we could be secure within the laws of nature, which would be God's system. And therefore, I'm secure with God. The thing is if we just were discussing Mishlei, Proverbs, right? That how the system, how the laws of nature work, right? And how Proverbs point out how the philosophy of Torah works within our everyday life in the laws of nature, right? Okay. Now let's say for instance, when we see a wicked person and we see that he fails, and we're able to go back and see the steps, every step of the way, how, and we see how it works right from Mishlei, how the person made step by step mistakes, then we become secure, a little bit secure, in the fact that God's system really works, because my own mind tells me I see that it really works. You see? So I become secure about that system, how it's working. And if you could be a little bit objective about yourself, sometimes we ourselves make mistakes and we suffer the consequences. And if we could go back and check and see every step where we made a mistake, you see? The thing is that at the time that you're suffering, I don't know if you could do this, it might be possible, but I don't know. But at some point you should be able to look back and say, yes, it's true I suffered the consequences and I don't like it, but I should feel secure that I know how the system works, and I know that God's system really works, and therefore I should feel more secure about living in God's system. You see what I mean? David's level was when, in the midst of his suffering the consequences, when he has to worry about how to act in the best possible way to escape him and his people, and at that time he still recognizes that God's system, he feels totally secure in God's system, and that God's system is working. You see? And all this was prophesied by Nathan HaNavi, the prophet, right? Nathan the prophet. And so therefore King David knew that this was all a consequence of his action. So it's very probable that he thought of this, idea that God's system is truly working, that he is just paying the consequences of his own actions, and therefore he felt secure in God's system. The security of the righteous is not in some, it's God via God relating to me. In other words, I cannot relate directly to God, because God, I don't know who God is. But I relate to God via the method that God relates to me. And God relates to me through these systems. And therefore I must relate back to God through his very systems. And when I see his systems operating, then I feel secure within God, that I really feel secure that God's system is working, and therefore I can relate, then through that I relate directly to God. It is through that I relate directly to God, because I see that God's system is working, so I feel secure. For instance, if you felt the American system of justice was working, wouldn't you feel more secure than when it's not working? That's exactly what we're saying. That's exactly what he's saying. When you see God's system working 100%, you have to feel secure. But if you're not sure if it's working, then you feel insecure. That is the security of the righteous person. The question just now was security in God, what we mean by being secure with God. And when, just like in a system, we see that if the system is working, we feel secure living in that, let's say, a country. So the same thing, as we see more and more the system of God, and we see it working around us constantly, so then you feel more secure. But parenthetically, there was a separate question: can we undo the effect practically? In other words, when David is punished, or we're punished, can we? Or we're getting the consequences. Can we undo the effect? Right. The only thing, as I say, is like this: that let's say, for instance, a person is smoking and he gets sick as a result of his smoking. Now, when he stops smoking, now the disease will not get worse, and it could be that he could undo either most of it or all of it, but sometimes the disease has gone too far, and you can't undo it. The same thing in the spiritual world. The only thing that David could do with this situation is undo the emotion which brought about this consequence from God, you see? But the only thing is whether God will take away the consequence. That depends. Sometimes it depends if it's public, sometimes the type of sin. There's a lot of factors when it's undone and when it's not undone. That's a totally separate subject. All I'm saying is that the way to undo the consequences is to undo the cause of the consequences. Then whether you will have the consequences or not depends how far the disease went. So if it went too far, then you might still have some of the consequences, or you might have the consequences. Or it's possible that you undo the cause and you can undo the consequences totally. That depends totally on the situation. Okay? I'm just saying this parenthetically. Okay. Torah is a means of helping you see reality correctly. From our narrow view, we don't see the reality. We see it within the framework of our lifetime. But even if we see it in generations, it's hard to see the whole picture and what it was like. And therefore, Torah could show us a whole view, you see? Then once the Torah shows it to us, then we could really see it working in the everyday life. Then the more you see it working in everyday life, then you really see that God's system is really working. Because you first saw it through Torah, and then you see it through the physical world, you really see that God's system really works in the physical world. That's the security that we're talking about. Proverbs from King Solomon, Mishlei. And we're going to do chapter 10, verse 8. It says, as a wise heart takes commandments, and a fool with his lips will fail. Okay? The question that we have is, there's a wise person. What does it mean by a wise heart? And two, it says he takes commandments. If it's from God, so of course he should take commandments. And if it's not from God, then he shouldn't take the commandments unless he understands why. What is it should say a fool? What's a fool with his lips? Okay? Yes. The next question is what does it mean to fail? To fail at what? What area? General Patton one time said how to become a general. When I spoke about becoming a general. Says the way to become a general is to study any battle that you can get your hands on and to study all the aspects of why one side won, one side lost, all the factors involved. He said, and it's not for the purpose of remembering this or that battle, but to make it a part of you, second nature. You see? Proverbs is a book. In the beginning of Proverbs, King Solomon says that this book is for the beginner. Says a wise man can learn something from it, but however, it's basically for the beginner. Now, you'll notice over here he writes a lot of particular cases in everyday life. A lot of these ideas in Proverbs is maybe one or two ideas. You just get the one or two ideas, and then practice in life. Why does he have to write a book in so much detail? The answer is it's for a beginner. And the beginner needs the constant detail, you see, again and again to analyze this situation, what's the benefit, what's the harm, again and again, from every single different angle, you see, until it becomes second nature. Once it becomes second nature, then he has to live that way. He has no choice. Anything that's part of your nature, you have to live that way. See, it shouldn't be that you're scholastic, like I know this. Like I know this verse. Or I could tell you over knowledge, like a bookworm. It should be a part of you in the second nature, so that you actually think this way and start living this way. That's the important thing. So then then the ideas are like a command, because you have to live that way. Of the first half, okay, of the verse. Now the second half, the question is, what is a fool with his lips? Now lips, we mean that it becomes part of you, like ownership. You take a commandment. When you first start out with these proverbs, it's nice advice. It's in your conscious mind, and sometimes you think about it, sometimes you don't. Well, you don't know how to use it in all different situations. After a while, you start thinking this way. And once you start thinking this way, so then it becomes second nature. Then you've taken it, you've made it a part of you. The taking in the sense of ownership. Lips means it's superficial. He only speaks from the mouth, but it doesn't follow from the mind. Okay? Now. But over here in this verse, since we have to compare the first half of the verse to the second half, so it comes out there could be two possible interpretations. One is he's superficial about, or let's say he reads Proverbs, and he's just superficial. He doesn't define, he doesn't clarify, like we took apart every wise heart, commandments, takes, every single thing was analyzed. A superficial person would just look at it superficially. So therefore, in one way, that is the opposite of the wise heart. He doesn't really analyze anything. He just looks at things in a superficial manner. He looks at life. He looks at people all in a superficial manner, not in an analytical way. Okay? That's one possibility. There's a second possibility over here. What it means superficial is that he doesn't know the ideas, but however, he doesn't make it a second nature. It's superficial in the sense that it remains in the mind, but it doesn't become part of his nature, and in that way it's not usable, and therefore it's also superficial. It's like a person that has knowledge, but doesn't live by that knowledge and lives by the regular emotional ways that usual people usually do. There's, what's the best way of making something second nature? Okay? The first thing is a clarity of the subject, and that is to the Meiri, a commentary, medieval commentary, says that that a person should question an idea, that it should look, when he's questioning, it should look like he's trying to break a thing down. Why? Because that's really the only way of testing and clarifying any given statement. And so therefore, whenever you have any question, every aspect of the statement or subject should be questioned from every different angle, because the first step in making it second nature is the clarity of the idea. The idea is not clear to the mind, it can't become second nature. Second thing is that he must have many different aspects of the subject. In other words, like in Mishlei, we have like different proverbs from many different angles, you know, from different parts of life and here or there, all different angles, so that it's not only the clarity of this one, but it's the clarity of 20 or 30 or 50, so that the whole subject starts becoming clear. You must move throughout the whole subject so that the whole subject becomes clear and it becomes part of you, and the universals become clear. The thing is to review the old, but not to memorize. Review means to look at it as if it's the first time. In other words, your mind should be open to seeing new ideas when you go over it. To be able to do that, you have to practice. It doesn't come easy. We weren't trained that way in our school system. Chapter 10, verse 6. And the verse says, "A wing causes sadness, and the lips of a fool will fail." Or foolish lips will fail. That's better. "A wing causes sadness, and the foolish lips will fail." Okay? You know, like with the eye. How does the wing cause sadness? Question, in what way does the lips fail? Is it different than the other verse, or is it similar? Question is that what does the first half of the verse have to do with the other? On the last question, what does the first half have to do with the other? See, there are two things with the verse. One is, what is the subject? And two is what is the, what are the two parts of the subject? When you notice that the first half doesn't fit the second half, what you're really asking is, what is the subject of the verse? Okay? So what is a wink? What does a wink mean? Wink is a message which only the giver and receiver understand. That means there is some type of conspiracy between these two people. In this case, the fool with his lips, or the foolish lips, is a person who doesn't have a plan or doesn't have any strategy. See, conspiracy means a thought-out thing, you see, while a fool is a person that does not think things out. Is what is the subject matter of the verse? We didn't answer the question of cause of sadness. Subject matter over here is harming others. We're talking about a wicked person and a fool. The wicked person, you have to be more careful of than the fool, because the fool will fail, because everything, you'll see what he wants to do. He shows his anger immediately, so you know he's an enemy. He starts a battle too fast, and you never realize he shows his hand, you see. While if you want to cause sadness, In other words, if you're a wicked person, in other words, you want to harm somebody, so then you think it out. The fool who wants to hurt others hurts himself more. But the conspirator, the person that has a strategy and a plan, you see, he can, in the short run at least, he will, let's put it this way, he'll last longer in his wickedness than the fool. Get to the subject matter. Well, the first thing is we're talking about a wink that causes sadness. Okay? So, in other words, we're talking about a conspiracy against to harm others. Causes sadness. So we're talking about the conspiracy to harm others. Now, the fool will fail in what subject? That's the first half of the verse tells us what subject. Namely, to harm others. That's the subject. Okay? So, therefore, the fool, even in his wicked ways, will fail. In other words, most of the times we compare the fool to the righteous, so therefore he fails. Compared to the righteous, I mean, the righteous thinks things out and the fool doesn't. But there are wicked people that think things out and have plans. Those are the more dangerous. They could cause harm. Those are the ones you really have to be careful of. The others are just so obvious, and another problem. If you have a little bit of thought, you can protect yourself.
Yeah.
Okay? You know, in Jewish law, there are certain types of acts of sex that are not permissible. One of them is homosexuality. But the question came up of why is it wrong? What's the philosophy behind that prohibition that we're not permitted in homosexuality? Whenever you have a question like this, is the best thing is to look at the broad section, the broad subject of the question, and that is sex in general. What is the Torah's view of sex in general? How do they look at it? Why are certain areas are prohibited, other areas are not? Why aren't we free in all areas? Why aren't we prohibited in all areas? Why the distinction? Our greatest command that the Torah has, our sages say, that the study of Torah is equal to all the other commandments in the Torah. It should be involved in the world of thought and education and all aspects of thought. And like we said on our tape prior to this, that a person should be involved in the world of ideas and constant review till they become second nature to them. Right? In other words, it's not only that it should stay in the mind, but all the ideas of Torah should become second nature and a part of him by constant review. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, therefore, we must avoid anything that will hinder our advancement in the world of study of Torah. Now, what hinders us is an incorrect view of the physical world that becomes very difficult to undo. I'll give you an illustration. For instance, jealousy. Jealousy really represents a certain philosophy. The philosophy of jealousy is that you don't deserve what you have, but I do. The question is, on what basis are you saying that? But because there is no thought involved, you see, in other words, a jealous person does not think it out, does not realize that that's really the philosophy that they're living by.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we must be very careful of all these wrong views that we have of life. And the more we act upon these wrong, incorrect views, you see, then the more it becomes part of us, then that becomes second nature. What we have to try to undo are these false views that are given by our emotions, so that we could, and we should, replace it with the true views of the Torah. See with the sex that the amount of energy put into it in the writings of literature, in movies, in art, entertainment, and music, the energy that is put into sex has to be a tremendous fantasy attached to it. On any of the other fantasies, because you see that there's so much put into it. Proof to show that the fantasy of sex is that really sex is a certain removal of a frustration. Yet a person is not satisfied. Most people either actually go out to have many partners, or if they don't go out to many partners, they dream or daydream about having other partners. And so you see that really there's no need for other partners if it's just a removal of a frustration. What difference does it make? Physically, that's certainly all it is. I mean, psychologically, it's much more than that, and that's where the fantasies come in, where you're not satisfied. Satisfaction is really only because of all the fantasies that you have, not in reality. There's also no answer, because every masturbation must come with a fantasy. You cannot have masturbation without a fantasy. In fact, I would say that having a partner is less fantasy because there's a reality attached to it, while masturbation is a greater fantasy because it's total fantasy. In other words, insofar as the psychological part of it, it's total fantasy because it's not really happening. The Torah did was the Torah said that you should only have sex with responsibility. Okay? Now, there are a few responsibilities. First of all, the first responsibility, it should be only for procreation. So therefore, it becomes practical there. And also, if you get married, then there's a responsibility to the partners. Each partner to the other partner, there is a responsibility. And for the children. So therefore, sex entails certain practical responsibilities. So therefore, what the Torah did was to try to take it as far away from the psychological as much as possible and bring it and relate it to responsibility. Sometimes you don't have to actually have children. You don't have to procreate. But however, the situation is of marriage, where there are different responsibilities, where you're permitted, that's a legal question, whether you're, when you're permitted not to have children, to use birth control, and when you're not permitted to use birth control, that's a legal question. Okay? We're dealing just with the philosophical, and according to the philosophical, we have responsibility that it's a situation where at least you can have children, and two is the responsibility to the partner, and three, responsibility to the children. So there are different responsibilities which bring it into the world of reality. What do I mean by responsibility to each other? I mean, for instance, in certain marriages, the man has the job of making a living, and the woman has the job of running the home, or if the woman is out working, so then how they work out their responsibilities is the way they want to. But there is a certain responsibility to each other, and to each other's emotional needs, and not to hurt the other one, and then it becomes involvement. Since you're constantly together, there becomes a question of justice, because it's easier to hurt one another, so you have to deal with that aspect of a relationship, not to hurt another person. And of course, with children, it's the raising of the children and the education of the children. All these things is a tremendous responsibility. So therefore, we attach sex to responsibility to bring it into the world of reality and away from the world of fantasy. Get back to the original premise. The original premise was that the basic obligation is the involvement in the world of reality and study. And therefore, the way God set up the laws of sex was basically that to try to bring it away from the world of fantasy. Homosexuality, there's no practicality in it. There's no practical thing. You can't have children, and there's very little responsibility to each other, and of course, there's no children. An interesting medrash that says that that when Abraham was a young fellow, so he accepted the one God, and he didn't accept the God of Nimrod, who was the king at that time. And the medrash says that Nimrod set up a fire for 3 days. He built a fire, and so big, like even if you got close, you got singed. And he told him that if he doesn't accept the God of Nimrod, then Abraham will be burnt. And Abraham stood steadfastly. Now his brother was standing by and watching all this. And he wasn't sure whether to accept Abraham's God or Nimrod's, or to give him to Nimrod. So he thought in his mind, he says, well, watch and see what happens. If Abraham makes it through, so then he'll say he accepts the God of Abraham. Okay, Abraham doesn't make it through, so then he won't. Okay, so they took a little Abraham and they threw him into the fire, and it says that Abraham walked around the fire and nothing happened to him. That's what it says.
So when they came to Abraham's brother, Abraham's brother says, "I accept the God of Abraham." They threw him into the fire and he died. So I heard, I didn't see it inside, but I heard the Ramban ask the question, what's the difference between the two? Okay? The answer is very good. Whether it's, I'm not sure. I heard it in the name of the Ramban, but whatever it was, the answer is an interesting answer. He says the reason why Abraham was saved was because Abraham accepted God in totality. He didn't accept God only for the results. You see? He accepted God, whatever happens, he accepts God as the reality. And therefore, Abraham must do what he's supposed to do. Whether God will save him or protect him, that's a separate thing. You see? That's also the idea when King David was on the run. And according to his understanding, he says, "I'll be back." He says, "But if I'm not back, then I accept the will of God." So that means that you're accepting reality. Whatever God does, that is reality. As God is the source of reality, everything he does is real. So if you're a person that lives in line with reality, then whatever God does, that's real. That's it. That's the reality which I must accept. It's not a trade-off. Most people relate to God in a certain trade-off. And that was his brother's approach. If God will save me, then I'll accept him. But if God won't save me, then I won't accept him. Right? You see? A lot of people, when they pray, they have that in mind. God, I'll give you all the prayers you want, but you give me what I want. It's a good trade-off. You see? Not so Abraham. Abraham accepted God in totality. Whether he gets rewarded or not gets rewarded, if he has good things happen to him or bad things happen to him, this is a reality. And therefore, God is a constant. God is not dependent on what I receive from him. I'm not saying you do not receive. In other words, if you are close to God, then definitely God will do for you. But if that's your motive, if that's what's driving you, is only what God could do for you, and therefore you only remain loyal to God only on the condition that he gives something to you, that's not a true relationship to God. I'm not saying it's not a relationship, but there's definitely something lacking in it. But if God is going to save you, it's only when you don't care if he saves you or not. You accept God. And whatever God does, let God's will be done. You see? That is the difference between Avram and his brother. Okay? The question that was asked of me was, should a person buy a lottery ticket? Is it rational to buy a lottery ticket? Okay? Now, when I thought of this problem of how to make a decision, so this has to do with probability, whether a thing would come about, and it should be based on probability. And the probability will give you the reality of whether you should buy something or not. Later, okay? But however, I did speak to Rabbi Chait about this, okay? And he came up with a very, very interesting, more in line with me than with Shmuley's. My son Shmuley would be more in line with your field. Okay. But the thing is, in other words, for non-mathematical people, all right, Rabbi Chait wanted to say like this, that really, naturally, see, the question is like this. Should you live according to probability? And the question is sometimes, like for instance, let's say it's a matter of life or death. Now then, even if there's a small probability of a thing happening, many times you would take it. You see? While if in other areas, the probability doesn't, you know what I mean? If it's such a 1 in a million chance, then you wouldn't take it. You know what I mean? So the thing is that there is, probability is a mathematical thing. It could be quantified, But in life, not everything is quantifiable because there's a certain value placed on life. Okay? So that becomes the problem of how to evaluate all types of things in life. Because most of the time that you're going to have to make a decision in life has to do with probability. Okay? Now, Rabbi Chaib wants to say that a person naturally will know when to go according to the probability or not. He says the only thing is that you have to undo a neurotic act that comes in place. Like, for instance, most people, if they hear about a shark, they will not go swimming. But if they ask for the probability, I understand it's like 1 in a billion probability if you go swimming in a regular beach. I mean, unless they've seen sharks. But if they haven't seen, it's like a 1 in a billion chance that a shark is going to come in. Yet a lot of people will not go swimming. But these very same people will cross the street, you see, which the odds are greater for it happening, and the damage could be just as great or greater. You know what I mean? It's hard to evaluate which is going to do more damage. Mm-hmm. So the thing is that, you see, that's a neurotic decision, you see, that you will not go swimming, you see. Mm-hmm. So therefore a person cannot make a rational decision in those areas because the neurotic part of them. But if they undid this neurotic part, then they would be able to, then naturally you'll know exactly how to make decisions. For instance, I know of a case of a woman when they first came out with the problems with smoking, and she decided to give up smoking, and because of the tension, her husband was driving the car, and he was only going like 10 miles an hour. Without thinking, she got out of the car. She was banged up, but she wasn't hurt big because he was driving slowly. Now, in that case, I mean, you have to advise the woman to smoke, you see? Let's say, for instance, a person cannot live without smoking. And it's true, it's going to take away from his life, you see. The question is, you understand, is it worth it to live a longer life? It's a very particularized thing to the person. For some people, giving up smoking, yeah, that's the smartest thing they ever did, and they have a very rich life. Let's say you can't. Let's say it's impossible. That's a different type of person. An adventurer. The adventurer might live a very short life. He's going to put himself in danger. But if he didn't do it, might not enjoy life at all. So you'll have to start measuring. You have to start measuring all these different components. See, now a lottery again is an erotic thing because really the odds are so much against it that the probability of it happening, that it's out of the realm of reality that you should win. Like, what is it, 1 in a billion, 1 in 2 billion different odds, right? Now, the thing is that yet the fantasy of winning becomes so great. I mean, you feel, like you just feel you're going to win, and it's against all probability, but that's like an erotic act already. Something out of the realm of reality. It's naturally, if the odds are so great, why are you going to do it? You see? Mm-hmm. A person does a certain amount of things for work. He has to work the way he talks, the way he dresses, does certain things. But you can go neurotic where you have no life and everything is for work, and you know what I mean? Like you don't have anything. There's a certain point where the probability of it happening, in other words, if it's 90% chance of you losing your job if you do something, then you can't do it. But let's say there's only a 30% chance of you getting caught, or a 20% chance. There's a certain point where if you're going to stop every possibility of from losing your job, then you might not have a life. And therefore, it has to be evaluated where, in other words, if there's a 100% probability that you're going to lose your job, or a 90% probability, so then, of course, you're not going to do it. That'd be crazy. But what if are you going to close the gap on every 10% possibility of you losing your job? Every 5%, 1% thing? I mean, you wouldn't be able to do anything. In other words, it reaches a point where you just live a life. You don't live a life. You just exist. You see? Mm-hmm. So all these things, the richness of life versus the practicality and the probability, all these things come into consideration in making a decision. In a lottery, if we remove the fantasy of winning, and we just looked at it a practical point of view, right? Okay. Now, let's say you spend $1 a week on a lottery, right? That is a 1 billion chance that you're going to win. But if you put that $1 a week at the end of the year, if you put it away, right, at the end of the year, you have $50 plus interest. At the end of 10 years and 20 years, if you start, I don't know when you start buying lotteries, but I'm sure people by the age of 20 start lotteries, figure out how much you would have when you're 50. That would be, at least that money is the probability of you having that money is much greater. If you measure the odds, yeah, in other words, there are things that could go wrong and you could lose your money. It's possible. But if you measure the odds, at least here you have something. There the odds are you'll just be spending all this money and having nothing. You go according to probability. Mm-hmm. An observation. There are two motives for asking questions. One motive is for is to use the questions as a weapon to put people down and to hurt people. And one is to use it as a tool, as a means for investigation and understanding and clarification. Now, even though that the using questions as a weapon is a very evil thing, it's really despicable, but however, a person must always question. In other words, like this, let's say emotionally I recognize that that I ask questions because I want to put people down, I want to catch them. But however rationally I know that's not the true motive, I have to continue questioning because that's the only way I could find the truth and have in mind to try to get out and to try to work out that I should get out of that framework of asking questions to hurt and to put people down and to harm people and use it as a weapon and to try and change that framework and to go into the framework where I just question as a means of a search for truth.
The question is, if I am feeling angry towards someone because of the way they have treated me, or because I failed to make a counterpoint in an argument, and I'm wanting to somehow verbally get even with them, how do I undo the emotion that causes that?
The step that you have to take is take it out of the particular. In other words, you put it in a particular, the problem lies from within a particular situation. But the question is, if I ask you, what is the emotion, what would you answer? You said that the emotion is anger. So really it boils down to not that particular situation, but how would you deal with the emotion of anger? The thing that we have to ask is, what causes anger? What causes anger? In other words, what causes anger? So they said either I didn't get what I wanted or I was slighted. Now, could you define that illustration, what you gave, could you define what emotion that is? Okay, when you say, well, somebody treated me poorly, okay? Right, now, the question is, why should that bother you? Why does that bother you? You get your own way, okay? Now, when you don't get your own way and you're unhappy, what emotion is that? The truth is that's an ego problem. Anger, most of the time, stems, if you watch the causes around you, you'll see most of the times you are somehow didn't get what you want, okay? Which seems to be an ego problem. And the question is what was asked here, what is the emotion of ego? What is that? It's a nice word, but the question is, where does it come from? What is ego? That sometimes a kid, and sometimes you even see it in adults, that if they bang themselves against an object, they get angry with the object, as if the object did something to them. Okay? So the thing is how is that child, or an adult that acts that way, how are they looking at that object? How do they view that object?
definitely do not see that they caused their own harm. I mean, they really ran into the object. The object is not moving. It couldn't do anything to them, you see? But yet they blame the object. So what you see is that when anything goes wrong, by wrong meaning anything that they don't want, anything that runs against any feeling they have or physically or anything, it's not them, it's something outside of them that caused them this harm and therefore deserves their anger. Saying also, something happened which was against your will and you got angry at the person. Person has a different point of view or or slighted you, whatever, whether they noticed it or not. But the fact is that the anger, like, you don't understand, like, who is he to do this to me? Who is he to say this? And you jump up right away. It's the same type of thing. Might be done in a more mature way, but the fact is it's the same type of action whereby that anything that goes wrong is because reality is bothering me, is impinging on me. In other words, something is containing me or controlling me. Expression of non-satisfaction with the reality around me. See, the anger is an expression that I'm not satisfied, I'm not accepting the reality around me. Now, why am I not accepting the reality around me? Because the reality around me is not fitting into my needs. At this moment, when I ran into the table, that table is not fulfilling my needs. So there must be something wrong with the table because there can't be anything wrong with me. So it must be something wrong with reality. Right? That is that I believe is the ego. Is that clear? Any questions? You want something. In other words, whenever something goes wrong, whenever you're not satisfied in any way, then reality, there's something wrong with the reality. Because definitely, if I want it, it's right. So therefore, anything outside reality must be wrong. Even if I bang into a table, then the table shouldn't have been there. In other words, reality way of all my needs. Whether fantasy or not, I'm not dealing with fantasy, but it's mine. It is a fantasy. This very idea is a fantasy. You see, but we're trying to define what this fantasy is. That everything in the physical world must fit into my needs. Anytime it doesn't fit into my needs, so then there must be something wrong with the physical world, and I express my non-acceptance or my discontent with the physical world via anger. I'm telling the world, you're doing something wrong. You're wrong. It's not accepting reality, you see. It's saying that there's something wrong here because it's not fitting into my needs. That's what makes it wrong, is because it's not fitting into my needs, and therefore I get angry. Whenever you're dealing with an emotion, okay? Whenever you're dealing with an emotion, just having this idea is not enough. That will not remove the emotion. What has to happen is every time the emotion is awakened in any particular given situation, then once you leave the situation and you relax and you calm down, then analyze exactly what happened in that situation. In other words, this idea, what we're saying, must be applied to every time that the emotion is awakened. You must reanalyze the emotion in the particular situation. Where you said that if somebody disagrees with me, has a different point of view, and it suddenly gets my emotion, I get angry with it, right? Now, the thing is, let's understand what is the reality here. The reality here is that there is a person that has a different point of view than you, right? Now, the thing is that if we just discussed that idea, you would say, well, of course, people could have a different point of view than I. Would you say that? Would you agree? That's a reality. Whether they're right or wrong, we'll have to analyze it and discuss it. It's a question of, is he right or wrong? Okay? Now the question is, why do you get angry? You see? The thing is what happened was your emotion at that moment says, by what right does he have to disagree with me? Who does he think he is? Like he's doing an injustice, and therefore you get angry. But if I ask you, not when your emotion is awakened, when I'm just talking logically, like we're having a discussion, and I would say, do you think people have a right to have a different point of view? You would say, sure. And I would say, how would you check out whether he's right or wrong? Well, we'll have a discussion, and we'll question each other until we see who's right and who's wrong. That's the only way. But yet, when you get angry, the emotion accepts it in a different way. The emotion is saying, who is he to tell me what's right or wrong? Who is he to question my reality? My reality is right, and he's wrong. And therefore, I have the right to, he's impinging on my reality. Therefore, I have a right to get angry with him. And I express it through anger. As an illustration, every time you get angry, the situation should be analyzed in precisely that manner, and slowly but surely you can remove your anger.
Question is, for example, let's suppose a person ran a small business and had clients and prospects and people he dealt with, and despite the fact that he did very well for those people and was very considerate to them, they basically jerked him around and didn't follow through with what they said they would do and all kinds of things. Is the question then that once a person has worked through their anger, they would simply accept that as face value and not be emotionally affected by it and just work with it?
The tzaddik, or the righteous person, only looks at the world practically, in a very practical manner, and then through the eyes of what is real and what is not. That's all. Now the question is, he has to make a living, and he has to make a living with people that some people are not nice. Some people are unjust. Some people are out to hurt him. Okay? Now the question is, practically, how can he protect himself? How can he protect himself? Through a study of Torah, he learns how to make plans and strategies. So he'll stop and think about how practically can he protect himself against these people. But anger is just saying, I don't want to accept reality. Is there a reality that there are evil people here? That people that are out to hurt you, it's a reality. Now the question is, how do you deal with it? Practically, all you want to know is how to deal correctly in any given situation. You see, that is very different than the emotion of anger. The emotion of anger is saying, you don't have a right to do that, and I'm going to punish you. I'm going to be angry with you, and I'm going to put you down, and I'm going to tell you off. That's just an expression of everything I do is right, and anything that goes against what I feel, then that person has to be put down. With that reality, like in a child, they'll yell or even hit a table that they ran into, you see? But the tzaddik, however, just looks at it as a practical thing. Why am I dealing with these people altogether? I'm dealing with them only insofar as making money. Now I have to take into consideration who and what they are. Now, once I figure out who and what they are, right, then I'll learn how to deal with them. And I'll analyze how they operate and how to protect myself against them. Right? There's a very, very famous case. There was a man by the name of Jacob. And he had to deal with his brother Esau. And he made two plans. He had three steps in his plan. The first step was he sent him many presents to appease him. Right? The next part of his plan was they separated into two camps. And Rashi says he was preparing for war, because if one failed, then the other could escape, which he was preparing for war. It was a strategy of war. Third one, he prayed to God that one of those two ways should work. You see? But if he reacted as an ego, he would say, who is Esau to tell me what to do? I'm not going to send him anything. I like to see him, let him try anything, you see? That's ego speaking. Yaakov said, I prefer not having a war, because even if I win, there's always harm. When you have a war, people on your side are going to die. There's going to be pain. I prefer avoiding bloodshed. It's worth it for me. No ego, no problem. Very practical.
let me send him as much as I need to satisfy him. Doesn't matter. So I'll have a little less. Doesn't matter. You see? But if that doesn't help, then I do have to prepare for war. Then I have to prepare that maybe God will help me and intervene for me so that, I get through prayer. That's also a practical thing, to pray to God that my plan should work. You see? So that's how the tzaddik relates, not by ego. Right. We hold that to undo all your emotions and to, it takes a long time. But however, what we do hold is that you shouldn't make decisions based on your emotions. And the way to evaluate and to analyze this area is not whether you get angry, but whether you make a decision based on that anger. In other words, you should work on, even though I'm angry, I shouldn't make a decision based on that anger. I'm not saying you shouldn't work on undoing anger, like we said before, the process. But in the meantime, at least try that even when you're angry, or not to make a decision while you're angry and wait till the anger passes, and at least to make decisions based on the situation and not on your anger. Okay? In other words, that would be a first stage before you actually undo the anger. You work on making decisions, but never allow your anger to make the decision, but only the situation, practically, what does the situation demand?